Can a solution for Ghana work in, say, Germany? The answer is no, obviously. But what does that mean to the quest for global sustainability? The Holcim Awards 2023 wrapped up in Venice almost 2 weeks ago. Out of 2,300 registrants, 500 submissions from 5 regions met the strict entry criteria. 20 stood out. So what were the big takeaways? Which finalists showed ambition? The heads of each jury are here to share the view at the top. Welcome to Ecogradia, where we meet experts and practitioners at the front lines of sustainable architecture and urbanism. My name is Nirmal Krishnani. I'm a sustainable design strategist, author, and educator based in Singapore. I had the chance to attend the latest Holcim Awards in Venice, which again this year was a snapshot of the global conversation on sustainable design and construction. Here, I sat down with the 5 heads of jury, one per region, who steered the judging process. Manit Rastogi from India, Belinda Tato from Spain, Leslie Loco, who is of Ghanaian Scottish descent, Craig Rikers from the US, and Tatiana Bilbao from Mexico. As heads of juries, they got to see up close how sustainability is shaping the future of architecture in every corner of the world and were eager to share what they had witnessed, what might be learned from and applied to other projects moving forward. But before I bring them on, let me quickly remind you that if you're unfamiliar with the people and projects discussed or would like to learn more, go to ecogradia.com to view pictures, notes and links that we have compiled on the episode page. This season of Ecogradia is sponsored by the Holcim Foundation for Sustainable Construction. The foundation was created in 2003 to empower a community of future makers through the transfer of ideas, knowledge, and real-world solutions. The Holcim Awards are a centerpiece of the foundation's calendar. The ceremony in Venice saw many thought leaders from around the world in attendance, including Pritzker Prize winner Francis Carey. You can view the recording of the event and subsequent panel discussions at holcimfoundation.org. I first sat down with Manit Rastogi, co-founding partner of Morphogenesis India, who was a guest on the first season of Ecogradia. Now, Manit was the head of Asia Pacific jury this year. We talked about the challenge of density, the emphasis on rural developments, and the rediscovery of local craft and materials in this part of the world.
So happy to have you back on Ecogradia. I'm really excited about meeting you here today and talking about the jury for the Asia Pacific. Talk to me a little bit about your view of that region. First of all, as you as an expert practitioner living in that part of the world, how diverse and how unified is it?
It may be a region, but it's really not. It's a universe in itself. It's a cosmos. I mean, you're looking at countries like India, the world's largest democracy, population of 1.4 billion people, with many issues that are pertaining to the simplicity of humanity, like clean air, clean water, sanitation issues, high density cities, lots of migration. And then you have China, which has gone through that process. Again, one of the world's most populous nations. And they've gone ahead and over the last 2 or 3 decades developed tremendously, which is what India is doing now in a way. And in fact, their issues are completely different. And even within China or within India, you have 5 climatic zones, you have multiple typologies, you have multiple price points, cost points. There, you know, the variety is tremendous. And then you have Mongolia, you have city-states like Singapore, which are more or less, you know, advanced. Australia, New Zealand, you know, it's just about everything that the world has to offer, all put together. So it's like trying to evaluate a region which has about 100-year gap between where one part of one country may be, mm-hmm, compared to a one part of another country. So it's not only us, we are evaluating projects in one slice of time, but it's not one slice. Mm. We have to view it as a 100-year gap of history, of evolution in terms of economics, sociocultural issues, political issues, and architectural responses to the condition.
One of the big challenges I see in, particularly in Asia, perhaps less so in Australia and New Zealand, is this challenge of density. It can go up to 100,000 people per square kilometer, which is unheard of in many parts of Europe or even North America. So that's a thing that I think it's very particular about where we are. Density is such a huge problem. Was density an issue that emerged in this competition? Was there a conversation around that?
Yes, there was. And but you know what we saw in all the entries is that projects that were dealing with extremely high density were far and few between.
Mm.
And the predominant number of projects were trying to find alternative methods of how do we live? I mean, how do we work? How do we live outside of that high density? Is there a solution outside of it?
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of was an underlying theme, I think, that was coming through from all the entries. That is crowded, large, populous cities the only way to be? Is there another way out? And so I think in that sense, it was very refreshing at one level. But at another level, I think we were missing out that white elephant in the room, the question of that big density, the mm. question of that many number of people living in very small spaces.
Mm.
Two of the four finalists really played up the idea of adaptive reuse in rural settings using vernacular know-how. Did you think that these were very replicable, you know, in terms of what they had to offer other cities, other settlements outside the city?
A lot of the problems of density and population in the Asia-Pacific region, and especially countries like India and China and Indonesia and others, is the issue of migration. People moving from rural areas to city centers, and it's this, and the entire region believes in the fact that cities are economic generators,
mm-hmm.
which then sort of attracts people to the cities, which causes, of course, great pressure on the city, pressures on affordable housing, rental housing, issues of sanitation, all of that. And what was interesting about the project that we saw, the winning entry, was that it sort of looked at the rural area, and it took a Tulu and said, you know, can we do something with this, which not only provides adaptive reuse and conservation and culture and all of that, but actually becomes a place where people don't need to migrate out of the
right.
Out of the rural areas. In fact, can we try and do something where we do reverse migration, where we attract people back and give them a living? You know, can these be areas where people work, where people learn, where people live?
Right. And the Mongolian project, the GERT.
That's right.
The kind of expansion of the vernacular with the modern, that was another interesting juxtaposition of how we bring vernacular know-how into today's context. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So I think in the Mongolian context and then the climate, the vernacular solutions to living are incredibly interesting. I mean, you know, it's quite an extreme climate.
Mm.
And an extreme terrain. And rather than, you know, so we see a lot of good architecture today inspired by the vernacular.
Mm.
And then sort of it uses a lot of modern materials and, you know, sort of reconfigures it in a way which makes it livable in the modern context. However, what we liked about this project is that it did an insertion. It took the vernacular and inserted something modern into it.
Right.
And the hybrid actually made, if you can stitch the past and the present and find a way to the future, it's, you know, so we thought that was a really exciting way of dealing with it.
So what about the ones that didn't make it? I'm sure it's tough coming to a decision on the top four, but there would have been a lot of other projects that were in competition for those rankings. So what did the others have to say? What were the themes that emerged?
There were some very interesting ideas. There was one project I remember, which was a floating restaurant made out of bamboo. And underneath the restaurant, on the water, there was shrimp farming going on. So it was a shrimp restaurant. So you'd go there, they'd take the shrimp and cook it and give
cook it.
It,
right
and
away.
It was a very simple project. I mean, I really liked it. And I generally tend to like things, which tend to do a lot more with a lot less. I mean, that's sort of my bias. But someone that you said, you know, it's great, but does it really do enough?
Mm.
And that is what we were all looking for. Does it really do enough? Does it really push the bar enough to inspire other people to replicate something like this?
Right.
So there were a lot of projects there that were, you know, let's put it this way, that if I was in an architecture school, I'd be hard pressed not to give them all the first prize. Okay, because all did something, But I mean, the problem of juries and awards is that it's really not, it's not necessary that the winning projects are the best ones, but are they really putting out the right message?
Right. One last question. How was the process? I mean, I know when I was jury chair, it was, you know, there were highlights and there were low moments. It was a struggle at times because it's also driven to a degree by personality. I mean,
so, you know, I think as a jury, and we had a very diverse jury. So we had building physicists, we had architectural practitioners. I mean, we had a whole variety in that jury. That was, and I think, in you know, it's in one sense, it's like the demon Ravan, the you know, the god with ten heads.
Ten heads.
So you know, so there are two aspects to that, to the demon or the god. Some people think that he had 10 heads because he had the wisdom of 10 people, and some other people think that, you know, He had the cruelty of 10 people. So,
right.
However, I think we sort of managed to be the wise 10 wiser.
Belinda Tato helmed the Europe jury. She is founder of Ecosistema Urbano, based in Madrid, Spain, and an associate professor in practice at the Harvard University Graduate School of Design. There was much to unpack in this vast region, which, according to Belinda, is experimenting with materials and retrofits.
Thank you so much, Belinda. It's a pleasure to have you with us in Ecogradia. I want to talk about your experience in the jury, as a jury chair of the Europe region. What are the common ideas that affect the whole region, and what are some of the unique ideas that affect different parts of the region, and why?
It was very interesting to see the diversity of projects. So there were projects that were about, you know, new materials and about very minimal or surgical interventions, all the way to more kind of ambitious, you know, urban design interventions. There was biodiversity, there was, you know, and zero emissions buildings, there was energy efficiency. So there was all these kind of, you know, different ways of addressing sustainability at different scales. And there was also interventions in existing buildings, but also, you know, buildings from scratch. So, you know, a little bit fair, everything. One of the things that I missed a little bit was there was not that many urban or landscape projects. Mm. It was, you know, the majority of the projects of the submissions were buildings, like very purely architecture.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that kind of struck me a little bit.
I had a look at the four projects and I thought there were a couple of themes that struck me. The Natural History Museum London project was an interesting way of using urban space and kind of recreating ecological systems there. The one from Madrid was an adaptive reuse project. This seems to have been a common theme of taking things that are there that are not living to their potential and transforming them. The second thing that I noticed was this idea of timber as a contemporary material of choice. I say that because in some of the other regions, timber is very much an old method.
Okay, yeah.
Kind of a rediscovery of the vernacular knowledge and so on. But here in Europe, it's being seen as, from a technical point of view, but also as a contemporary material.
Yes.
Talk to me a little bit about these two big ideas. Is that something that's peculiar to Europe?
There were a number of projects, and actually it was interesting to read that, you know, they shortened the construction processes, and it was usually mixed solutions. It was not just timber, it was timber plus steel or timber plus concrete. So in particular, in the third prize and the acknowledgement prize, they're both working with timber structure. So it seems to be the new kind of material, and there is a lot of sophistication in the solutions, and it's beautiful. So
yeah. Do you think there was enough here that can be easily replicated?
I think the social aspect is very important. So there was a number of projects, not only the one that were kind of awarded, but additional projects that were kind of questioning or bringing to the table the idea of new models of governance, new models of occupation of the space, new models of management, because I think we have to start envisioning new scenarios. You know, there is a number of problems right now, not only in Europe, of course, but also beyond Europe. And one is the access to the housing. Like, you know, surprising to see that housing is becoming less and less affordable for almost everyone, and that doesn't make any sense. So So there were a number of people who were questioning this again. You know, it's like, you know, what is there any other way of using space and being able to live, you know? So yeah, I like this idea of kind of innovation in that way. We have a huge built heritage in Europe. There's a number of buildings that are not utilized, or they're deprived, or they're forgotten, or they're abandoned, or they're in use, but they're not in very good condition. So for me, the question that I have for Europe myself is like, how can we make it more efficient? How can we work with existing buildings and existing, you know, energy embedded in these buildings? Mm. How can we think about the life cycle of the whole building, or how can we transform them in the most, you know, positive way? So there is huge potential there.
The conversation seems to be shifting towards, how do we make use of what we have?
Yes.
And it's a whole other way of thinking about sustainability, of whether it's forgotten spaces in the city, or whether it's materials that are readily available but low impact, or whether it's existing structures and adaptive reuse. So there is this kind of almost philosophical shift underlying what we're seeing over the last 20 years, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This idea of the urban mining, like, you know, trying to understand that the city is already there, you know, what can you get? How can you transform it? And then I would also emphasize the fact that after the pandemic, there is a shift. You know, cities are changing. I mean, in the US, they're changing. They're changing a lot. There is, you know, people have moved and people have not, you know, come back. Mm. So there is a lot of office space that will have to be rethought. There is a lot of retail space that will have to be rethought. So there is a number of trends that are impacting cities, and we really have to intervene in these existing structures because you know, they're very valuable, but at the same time, these are the ones that bring people together. So
what was the process of making that final decision?
There were some projects that were exploring very technical solutions, again, trying to improve a facade of an existing building. So it was interesting because, you know, the before and after images were very similar, but still they were, you know, but it was very technical. So again, you know, how ambitious a solution is when it is not so visible, but maybe super efficient. And, you know, how can you balance that out? There was also some other projects, you know, large scale intervention, but maybe there was, you know, there was a little bit of less information regarding, you know, the natural species and the materiality. So yeah, of course we did have our exchanges. There was some projects that were, you know, we made an individual evaluation of the projects online, and then we met as a group, and only then we all had the access to, you know, the different evaluations. So of course, you know, the scores were kind of, you know, different. You know, one person evaluates something or values something and the other one not. And that's the beauty.
That's
because
the beauty.
It's like, you know, I want to listen to you. It's like, why did you like this project so much? Or why didn't you like this project?
Mm.
And then, of course, you know, we did different rounds to make sure that we didn't leave anything behind. So we were, you know, really trying to make sure that we were kind of covering everything. And so, of course, prices were moving up and down, and then, you know, we ended up where we were.
Middle East Africa this year was steered by Leslie Loko, OBE, founder and director of African Futures Institute based in Ghana, also the curator of the 2023 Venice Biennale of Architecture. This region, says Leslie, offers an altogether different perspective with emphasis on community seeking to revive social and economic systems.
Leslie, thank you so much for joining us on EcoGradia. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for the invitation.
Wonderful. I've always believed that sustainability is a very contextual question. Mm-hmm. I'm glad to see an award that doesn't sort of try to universalize it by painting these big regions. But even then, Middle East and Africa, that's a big, big part of the
world. It's a very big grouping. I mean, I think, you know, sustainability as a topic, clearly, I think people are understanding it as much more complex than it was, I don't know, a decade, 2 decades ago.
Mm.
And I think there's been a tendency to think about it in quite scientific terms, quite measurable terms. But one of the things about a grouping like Africa and the Middle East is that you have an incredible range of resource disparities.
Mm.
And to be sustainable in a context where you have fewer resources, fewer choices, fewer routes to take, you have a very, very different conversation about extraction, about energy, about surplus. Mm. So combining, you know, the 54 countries of Africa with, you know, I mean, Turkey was included in the Middle East, which is also, I mean, there were some quite odd groupings.
Right.
So there's a kind of geopolitical lens, I guess.
Yeah.
And that made it quite difficult, I think, in the jury process to arrive at any easy consensus.
Right.
And what we found a lot of the times was that we were relying on jury members' understandings of particular contexts in order to be able to discuss projects.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if somebody understood what it's like to build in Nigeria, talking about that to somebody who was building in Morocco or building in Istanbul, the conversation was as much about the context in which we were judging as the project itself. So that was quite interesting about the process. I think we all came away learning a huge amount about our respective, I guess, knowledge zones. Yeah,
it's interesting you say resource constrained, countries or sub-regions, but doesn't the Middle East also include some countries that have tremendous resources?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah. So that's why it was, you know, to judge a project that's coming up in, let's say, Dubai or Sharjah or, you know, the UAE against a project that's coming up in Sierra Leone, for example.
Right.
It's really hard to understand what are the principles of sustainability being applied in each context relative to the choices that people have.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you could see, yeah, you know, a project that's made out of sandbags and, you know, mud and incredibly sustainable at one level, but that's actually because that's the only building material that was available.
Right.
Somebody making a decision in Sharjah to use XYZ is a very different, it's a different context. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it comes down to ambition to a degree, and that ambition has to be measured against what's available.
It does, but I also think in certain contexts, particularly in Africa, which is I guess the area that I know, I mean, I can't say I know the whole continent, but it's certainly the area I know best. The conversation is often not about sustainability in the way that the global north or the, let's say, industrialized countries would understand it. It's more about use. It's about the traditions of doing something. It's about a different relationship to the environment. Sometimes it's even about a different relationship to language. So there are some very, very interesting ideas that emerge in traditional ways of building, which in their context wouldn't be understood as sustainable. They would simply be understood as just the way you do things.
I mean, I was looking at the four finalists and, you know, and asking myself, what does it say about architecture or design as an agent of change? They're almost like acts of acupuncture rather than sort of the big scale master planning. Is that a theme that recurs in this region, that because of the lack of resources or because of the struggle to build?
I'm slightly more skeptical of the narrative that positions Africa as always having less, but I do think there's an ethical dimension to questions like surplus, to abundance. And so it's, for me, it's not so much making do, it's making in a different way.
Right.
And that's a long-term conversation, and it has huge ramifications for the way that we think about resources.
Mm.
So it's not, you know, I think Africa is often positioned as the continent that has the least. I'm in favor of a conversation that sees that differently. You often find projects quite small in scale because they're often by younger practices who are starting out or doing something that's a bit more experimental.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, has a knock-on effect on the types of projects that come forward for inclusion in these awards. And really interesting to see as well how a really good piece of architecture can catalyze change in ways that people in the communities in which these buildings take place often don't understand that architecture can do that. So, you know, the Surf School in Ghana, for example, has become this absolute hub. And I mean, I just happen to know it. Surfing was never an activity that, you know, we don't surf. Now there's this kind of jewel of a building that has galvanized a whole youth community. Those sorts of catalysts, I think, are incredibly important because it also elevates the conversation around what architecture can do.
Mm.
So it's a different scale, different set of resources, but the impact is often larger.
Not many projects talked about the city, did they? That seemed to be, I mean, as an observer, I'm wondering if the design of cities is a pressing issue in the continent.
I'm sure
it is.
Yeah. I mean, but it's also to do with the slowness of the architecture profession to really get involved in city building.
Mm.
Much of our city building is development led. It's government led. It's not, I wouldn't say design led yet.
Mm.
So, you know, unlike other regions of the world where, you know, the issue of sustainability, the issue of resource management is really high on the agenda of urban planners, urban designers and architects, we are in a much more laissez-faire kind of situation where cities literally just happen. And I think one hopes that in the next sort of 10, 20 years, you're going to see a shift in scale of projects coming out of these regions, which are not just about the bijou, small acupuncture intervention, but are actually much more intentional at the scale of the urban.
Right.
Yeah.
Tell me about the ones that didn't make it.
The ones that got away.
I remember that while we had to pick four, there were so many good ideas that maybe didn't make the mark at a certain level, but nevertheless were good ideas.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm just wondering if anything springs to mind in the remaining entries that or thematics that were coming out of that the bigger grouping.
So there were lots of projects that I think really encapsulated community build or, you know, careful resource management, but didn't have the level of inventiveness that other projects did. So there's quite a lot of conversation about that and what is the message that the jury is sending?
What was the message?
That I think you don't have to be rich to be creative. You don't have to have huge numbers of choices in order to make responsible choices.
Mm.
And that sustainability can be as much a way of thinking about the world as a way of building it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we were looking for projects, I think, that said that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Craig Dykers is the founding partner of Snoweta. He helms the New York office of this global design practice. Craig was the chair of the jury for North America. So much of what happens in this region, he says, is driven by its economy.
Thank you, Craig. Really happy to have you on EcoGradia. What's your personal take on what the issues are that are common to North America and perhaps what is not uniformly common to North America, and that there are as a granularity to this discussion?
Mm. North America refers mainly to an economic and political climate that is a little different from central regions of America and Southern America. The populations in all areas of the Americas are very diverse, so it's a kind of a stereotype to suggest that South Americans are one way and North Americans are another in terms of race and ethnicity. On the other hand, we do see economic differences that are incredibly powerful. And the regions of Northern America have to face real estate and commercial pressures that some other countries don't have to face necessarily. And Canada, of course, is also a wide-ranging country of where most of the people live in the southern band of Canada, and the smaller groups live north of the 49th parallel. And then even in that world, most live on the coasts, east and west, or along the Great Lakes. But the commercial pressures do play a part. It's been very slow in the region, except for maybe Canada, to approach sustainability as an issue that is embedded in our thinking. Mm. It's often brought in as an afterthought or something that's meant to show brand identity. We're green people. We are trying to be green. And so as a result, the process is incremental. You see small steps, much smaller than you might see in countries like Europe or other places where this process of sustainable thinking has been going on in a more focused way for a longer period.
One thing I was struck by in the Northern American finalists was the level of reporting.
Yeah.
I thought it was exceptional compared to a lot of the other regions. I mean, simple things like carbon and embodied energy and so on.
And data is, of course, one of the useful and important ways that we can judge a project, and the more data that's available about a concern helps us better understand the reality of how it works. And of course, data, to those who use it a lot, is not the end all of everything. You can see numbers on a page, and the numbers are useful, but there can be another perspective to those numbers. So you always have to use professional judgment in how you examine carbon footprint and so on. Mm-hmm. If there's a challenge to habitat as a result of how materials are made, well, even if it has a low carbon footprint, the habitat associated with it or loss of habitat is a challenge. Mm. So we're talking about it in the jury quite a lot from all those perspectives.
Yeah, just looking at the four finalists, I read a trend into the first three, the projects from Toronto, Seattle, and Bellingham, USA. They had a very strong systems approach, and yeah. There was a lot of thinking about how to integrate systems.
Yeah.
So I'm a systems person, so I was pleased to see that.
Yeah.
Then there was Muskau Pitung Powell Arbor. And yeah. I'm just wondering, how do these fit into the larger conversation that's taking place?
Well, in terms of the Powell Arbor in Saskatchewan, obviously, it's very difficult to recreate or transfer or scale to most of what we might call Western society or colonial society, however you want to call it. There aren't that many powwows that occur in these cultures.
What's a powwow?
A powwow is a gathering of tribal nations. It's okay. Both a spiritual, political, and social gathering, where people work with their traditions, work with their languages, interact with the times that they're facing. So there's many things that happen at a powwow, but it's a deeply rooted tradition across almost all of North America. Mm. So it changes when you get actually into the southern region, central region of America, but a powwow has a particular definition in tribal nations in the north. It's a fantastic celebration and incredibly meaningful. Mm. So the arbor protects those people from weather and elements, gives them a comfortable, safe place to carry out their rituals, and allows them to be with nature while at the same time with their traditions that are about the built environment. So it's not just under the sky, although they do have events that go outside and inside. So the reason that we thought it was important was that, there are different attitudes about nature, mm. different attitudes about the word sustainability, different attitudes about how we can build productively with the environment in mind. Mm-hmm. And this structure did that in a way that the West would never even consider in its basic approach to design and architecture. So it was a way of saying, hey, let's stop. This is a diverse country. There are thousands and thousands of people who are from tribal First Nations who have a lot to offer. Mm. And we need to learn from them too. And so this was our way of at least opening that door. Mm. It was a beautiful project.
Playing devil's advocate, I would ask the question of replicability.
I think one of the things that is complex for the West to grapple with in terms of sustainable thinking or climate change issues or environmental sensitivity is the ability to shift our understanding of comfort. Mm. We all want more. We want nicer sweaters. We want nicer homes. We want more places that we can be inside. And the modern industrial era has pushed us further and further inside of buildings and disassociated our connection to the natural world around us. Mm. I mean, how many times have you been walking in the street and it rains just a little bit? Tiny bit of rain and everyone freaks out. They'll run inside and find the closest place they can be at. What we see with a structure like the Powwow Arbor is that it's okay to be outside. You can build comfortable structures that allow you to connect to the elements. Right. And until we learn how to reconnect to nature, it will be very hard to change our mindset solely through data and technology.
Right. But just in terms of ideas and themes, what were the things that excited you?
We saw a little more connection to habitat than I was expecting. Mm. Although we did talk about that a lot, we want more. Mm. I think in this world, we have to stop thinking just about buildings. Mm. So we were excited to see in Northern America people talking more about habitat than I have seen in the past.
So, right.
This was important. Landscape architecture was growing in value. It needs to grow more, but we were at least happy to see something on the table. We were also happy to see people looking more specifically at the context of the world they were building within or mm-hmm. planning within. So cultural characteristics came through in many of the projects. New types of material use were very interesting. And as you probably are aware, Northern America or this whole region is incredibly focused on techniques and systems and modules. And the winners produced a very interesting proposal for how to modulate construction and allow it to be useful to clients.
Mm. Lastly, Tatiana Bilbao, who I first interviewed on Ecogradia earlier this season, guided the jury for Latin America. She is founder and principal of Tatiana Bilbao Estudio, based in Mexico. The finalists from her region, she says, reveal much about the use of resources such as water and timber, plus a deep felt concern for the community.
Tatiana, thank you so much for joining us at Ecogradia.
Very nice to be here with you again, Irma.
I'd like to get your take on Latin America. What do you think is common to the region that could be a baseline for discussion?
There are many, many other projects going on, of course. But we had many entries, and the majority of them, really the strategies behind the agency of the architect was pretty common and pretty different from other places, mm-hmm. no? So really the architect acting as a moderator, as a mediator, mm-hmm. as one of the makers of space was a common thread. And for me, that was very happily surprising, no? Mm. Because it really, many of the projects we had, the communities had a lot of agency, the cultural kind of aspects of it, the economics, the politics, the region, the route on the place had a big agency, no? Rather than kind of, I think that in other regions, the architect, no, is kind of the
author.
The author, mm. yeah. And in this case, is the mediator.
Mm.
And that was I was very happily surprised about that. And I could see that as a universal kind of approach in the majority of these projects.
Right.
And every project is completely different,
right.
rooted to its own context, no, in many ways. So that was very hard to judge, because how would you compare a project done by the neighbors of a block in Antioquia versus a university building in Quito, you know? Mm. I mean, the community of the university building is completely different than that community in Antioquia, no, for example. I mean, just to mention a few, which they were not even in the finalists, but that is the thing, no? How do you then discuss about it? So the discussions we wrap our minds about around it was how the weight of the community, no? How the agency of the community is that really there? Is that really defining it?
Mm.
Is it really something that will become universal for every other community member? Because obviously not every community member participates. Would that be replicable? Can that be maybe an example of a strategy that could be applied somewhere else?
Right.
And then the questions become completely different, right? So more profound. And I think that was super interesting as well.
Hmm. So it's a common approach to diversity.
Yes, exactly.
I had a look at the four finalists, and I detected a couple of perhaps secondary themes, but I just want to get your take on it. Water, for example, seems to be a very persistent theme and its relationship to public space and community. Why is water such an important thing?
There were a lot of projects with water, but and crazy, the projects we chose as finalists have to deal with that. But it was not the common thread, I have to say. No. So I think that part of the jury was super interested on topics with that, because definitely it's something that is becoming an urgency in many, many of the our cities in the whole world because of climate change, et cetera, et cetera. We all know it. But I think that one of the key aspects in Latin America is that water has always been a source of power because it's not universally free for all.
And I mean, is it a preoccupation of the designers, or is it actually in a very real sense a crisis in the region with water?
There's a crisis of water since long, no? And as I said, I think that we cannot say it's like now we're going to run out of water.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't water in the first time, you know? So it is kind of also that access to water. There was water, but there was not access. There was no universal access to water.
Right.
So I think that that is the common thread. And now with what is happening, that we know that there's more and more droughts, no? For in some regions, more and more floods, which also some projects dealt with that. And in other regions, more drought. Kind of, I think that was what we really kind of liked of the approaches of those projects dealing with it.
The other interesting recurring theme I thought was local materiality and craft.
Absolutely. And there are two reasons, right? The first is obviously because the communities are much more involved. And that's possible, although it's never a constant that the community will prefer the traditional local things. No, now the trend is that obviously we have, as society kind of said, that the industrialized materials are modern and are progress, you know, mean progress, means also a status and all these things. But having said that, there are still, no, a lot of communities really fighting for really holding to their local knowledge, but especially because a lot of them have realized that this is a very, not only sustainable way, economical way of doing a lot, no? The school, Nueva Venecia, that's New Venice, and it's crazy that they got the prize in Venice, right? I was talking to them yesterday. I said, well, you have a lot of Venice in your professional life that should be thankful to. But anyway, no, the region, they built these houses in stilts in wood because they source it locally.
Right.
So it makes completely sense. That makes sense, you know?
Yeah.
So it is also kind of what you're saying is in these regions it's not a trend. You know, it means a resource that is there and it's locally produced and is available to build things.
Right. Talk to me about the ones that got away, the ones that we didn't get to see.
For me, there was specifically a project in Paraguay, which is a housing project. I knew it before. I have seen a lecture of the architects before, and I think it was really, really, really beautiful. It is a very clever project, kind of being built with the community, people designing their own spaces, understanding how they could create more density and more possibilities. And I like the idea that it was housing, but it didn't progress much because we were interested also. There were many, many projects, very interesting in terms of the scale of the impact that they have. So I think we were kind of debating very much into the amount, the impact they would create, no? Although in my heart, the impact that housing produces is very profound. But it's true that, for example, the project from Mexico, this very strong program really will support a full community of people, which is a more probably rapid impact, let's say, no? More direct and rapid impact rather than housing that it's a long term because, okay, you hold 25 families, no? At the most in this case. And then, okay, this will create an impact on them, but then to replicate it to community takes a long time.
Mm. So would that have been the baseline criteria, the replicability of a project and hence its potential impact down the road? Was that what kind of separated?
I think rather the impact, no? First, and then the replicability. In this case, as I say, I think the replicability relies on the strategies, no? Those are the only things that you could replicate because these projects are very rooted
in the locality,
in their context. So we were thinking of impact much more, no?
Right.
And yes, as I said, when you create impact and it's positive, the strategies should be copied.
My last question to the juries was what advice they'd give future entrants, anyone seeking to make a mark in the world of sustainable construction.
For this particular region, for Asia Pacific, my message to future entrants is please bring all kinds of projects to the table. Sustainability is not about typologies, it's not about scale, it's not about size, it's not about cost. It's about taking the elephant in the room and trying to do something better. So, you know, if you have a large mixed-use development, if the projects are developer-driven, bring that to the table. But demonstrate what is that one thing you've been able to do with that that makes it slightly better. And I think for this region, that's critical. It's more than half the population of the planet, that one region. So what happens here is critical for the planet.
Right.
Again, what I missed the most is, you know, we're facing climate change with a lot of impact in many parts of the world. One of the impacts is extreme heat that is going to be hitting. It's already, but it will be even worse. So I was missing a little bit more of urban scale projects to mitigate heat. So, you know, again, how can get cities prepare to be more resilient in the coming years? And so this ambition, and for me, Holcim Award is super important because it's about, you know, showing what is next. Like, you know, we already know about many things, but, you know, how can you start tackling the problems that we already know we're going to be facing, right? So the idea of renaturalizing cities, bringing cities, making them more permeable, working with water, which is also a very scarce resource, and there was going to be more problems with water in many different parts of the world.
What I want to say to all young architects is put yourselves out there, because if you assume that competitions like this are not for you, that they're somehow out of your reach, we'll be talking about the same issues in 50 years' time. So put yourself out there, number one. And number two, think outside the box. You know, I think there's often an assumption that, especially coming from our part of the world, that you're entering into a discourse that's closed and fixed, and your job is to somehow match the expectations or the standards or the levels elsewhere. Actually, no, we're in charge of our own narratives now. So if you have ideas about not just sustainability, but about building, about your place in the world, about your relationship to the built environment and the natural environment, put those ideas out there. Because that's how conversations evolve.
I believe that landscape and habitat have to have more focus. Even the wording of most of the award talks about a building or a project usually related to a building. And I think getting out away from that type of terminology, allowing people to see that a site and all the surrounding sites of a project or have any, the project will impact those places would be helpful. So that's one thing I'd like to see. And the other is perhaps, yes, a rethinking of regional identity and regional descriptions of who people are and why they're being segregated in the way they are.
I was very happy with what I saw. I was really like, thinking, okay, there's life, there's light at the end of the tunnel. So if we can see more of these projects, that would be amazing. I would like to see more housing, really, and more progressive way of making neighborhoods starting from the main unit. So more, not only dedicated projects to housing, but more complex projects with projects that have housing at its core, probably, and other types of proposals. Because what we saw were large scale projects that impact in large scale. So I'm not surprised if next time we see those types of initiatives. Mm.
Looking back, the winning projects this year have, I think, been a testament to resourcefulness and imagination. The award ceremony itself was the kind of celebration we all need to remind us that as long as there are creative minds at work out there, there is hope. And on that note, thank you everyone for tuning in. There is much more about this episode waiting to be unpacked at ecogradia.com, where you can also find all past episodes, their summaries, galleries, and notes on dedicated pages from the first episode of season one up to now. If you enjoyed today's interviews, please subscribe to Ecogradia on your preferred directory or listening app, or leave us a review. Your good words matter and could, in fact, pique the interest of others, your friends, colleagues, or maybe guests on our wish list. Your support can help this podcast grow and keep sustainability on everyone's radar. This is our last episode of season three. We will be back in a couple of weeks with a bonus episode, which will feature highlights and additional content from this season. Please follow us on social media or subscribe to our newsletter where you can find out when the first episode of season four will be out. Don't forget to check out our sponsor, the Holcim Foundation for Sustainable Construction. Go to holcimfoundation.org to find out about the great work that they do, all the resources gathered on their website, and simply get inspired. Before I go, a big shout out to the team that put this episode together. Maxim Flores, Ecogradia's producer. Kruti Choksi Kothari is managing editor. Sana Gupta, our senior communications executive. And Alexander Melk, creative director, and Calvin Brown, sound technician and editor, both from Phlogiston. Thanks, everyone. Until we meet next, this is Nirmal Kishnani signing off in Singapore.